I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Ballot 2012 on Intersection. Florida's 10th Congressional District pits Congressman Daniel Webster against former Orlando Police Chief Val Demings. Both are well-known and well-liked, making this race nearly a toss-up. District 10 includes parts of Orange, Lake, and Polk counties. I'll talk with Dan Webster about his position on the issues. Plus, state leaders are proceeding with an effort to purge invalid voters from the rolls. A new state elections law is in place, and Deirdre McNabb, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, is here to help me sort it out. That's ahead on Intersection. Daniel Webster faces former Orlando Police Chief Val Demings. We invited Demings to join the conversation, but her campaign declined. U.S. Representative Daniel Webster is seeking re-election to Congress. Webster is a Republican and spent 28 years in the Florida legislature. He served as House Speaker and Senate Majority Leader before being elected to Congress in 2010. Congressman Webster, great to have you with us.
Great to be on.
Let's start talking about the economy. Congress is facing the so-called fiscal cliff at the end of the year. That's when tax increases and spending cuts are scheduled to hit all at once. And you've proposed cutting back government spending, even rolling things back to 2007 levels. Is this your solution to sequestration and other budget issues?
Well, I think at the time when I suggested that, it was a couple years ago, and we were in the middle of continuing resolutions. So there was it would have not changed anything to move back to that level other than the fact there was some growth in areas, but it wasn't like a sort of across-the-board cut. We had only been living under that budget further and further down the road. It does grow as it goes, but it doesn't actually change any of the priorities. I thought it was one way we could move towards getting our fiscal house in order, and I thought it was a good idea. I did, by the way, do that on my own for what I could do, and that was
personal budget, right?
Yes, my personal budget. And I asked if I could have my salary reduced. You can't do that because congressmen have to make the same amount. I think it's maybe even a constitutional provision. However, I did write a check to the Treasury at the end of the year to roll my salary back, and then I turned back almost $500,000 of my office expense.
So how would you propose to deal with sequestration going forward?
Well, we've dealt with it twice in the House. The Senate has been silent on the issue, even though there have been some rumblings of a group of – there's always a gang of six or a gang of eight or a gang of four, and they're working on it. But to me, the key is to make not necessarily across-the-board cuts in these areas, but to take a scalpel, find the things that everybody could agree in, and most of the things that we proposed in order to fix sequestration was from a bipartisan standpoint. And I think once you do that, put the money back in, raise the spending back to the level it was originally, and make the cuts in other areas of the budget.
If you return to Congress, do you think is that the biggest issue going forward?
There are so many big issues. I don't know that that may be one of the big issues, but there's also something called the SGR, Sustainable Growth Ratio, which is doctors operate under that. They are facing huge reductions in the amount of reimbursements they would be getting. It would cause a lot of harm in the healthcare system if we don't fix that. So there's that, and other things, including what to do with the existing tax cuts that expire at the end of the year. All of that is going to be coupled into the fact that we only did a continuing resolution on the budget, and it only carries us just into the next year. So we have all of those things and more to deal with. It's a big load.
Many listeners would probably agree that there are many problems facing Congress, but one of them on the Hill is intense partisanship that has at times almost brought the country to defaulting on various things. And how would you engage with members of Congress in both parties to find a solution to overcoming partisanship. I know you're part of a members' breakfast that is bipartisan, but what do you think else further you can do as a congressman from Central Florida?
Well, I just used the technique I used in the Florida legislature. Granted, it's not quite as partisan. The stakes aren't quite as high there, but there is some partisanship, and there are two parties there. And I was able, not only in the minority when I served there for 16 of the years I was in the legislature, but then the 12 I was in the majority, I was able to build partnerships, friends, and great relationships, even with people who disagreed violently with some of my proposals. Still, we were able to build those relationships. I think that's one of the problems. When I got to Washington, I did a couple of things. First thing I did, I chose a office because I had a low lottery number, so I had a good pick. And I chose an office in Longworth, not necessarily in Cannon, where a lot of the Republicans are. So there's Longworth House Office Building, a little more Democrats there. I chose the ground floor, and the ratio is probably maybe one-third Republican, two-thirds Democrat. And I went around and met those people because I felt like the key was their a lack of relationships, and started there. It did some other things too. They're pretty interesting.
You pointed to past experience in the legislature, but that was a situation where both parties dominate both the state House and state Senate. And of course in the Congress, Republicans have a lead in the U.S. House, but in the U.S. Senate, you've got a different situation with Democrats leading there.
Well, no, I faced the same thing because I served in the minority for some time. And part of the time I was in the minority, there also was a majority in the Senate. And then there was a majority of both House and Senate Republican, House and Senate Democrats, and split. So I had some experience in all of those arenas. And I also served as Speaker under a Democrat governor, Governor Lawton Childs. So there are some similarities, I think, in learning how to work with people. So when I got there, I called three Democrats. And I had said, the first one to call me back, I'm going to ask them to sit with me during the State of the Union address. And I did that. First one to call me back, can't really pick who it is, was Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and known partisan and chairman of the Democrat National Committee. However, she agreed, and she came onto our side, Republican side, sat with me, and we said we maybe work together. And there's a whole story behind it. I won't go into all that. But it led to the creation of a group of people, Republicans and Democrats, equal number, meeting for dinner. And I'll give you the dynamic. This is what changes things. Some of the people that I invited, which were four Republicans to the first dinner, so there were five of us, and she invited four Democrats, so there's five of them. Some of ours said, we don't want to be in the same room with them. So that's how it is, and that's sad. I told them, well, they probably feel the same way about you. Let's just try it and see what happens. And it worked out fantastic. There was not a nay vote. And I'll tell you what the dynamic was. One person in that group told their story, how they got there, what their family was like, so forth, issues they were concerned about. And there were nine people listening. And the problem I found is people just don't listen there. They want to talk all the time. They want to demand to be heard. And that was a great dynamic. We've done that since then, doubling each time, three times. And the group is getting larger and larger. And the diversity in the group is huge. But there are relationships being built that would never have been built any other way. And I think that's part of the problem. That's not this whole solution, but that's part of it.
Should constituents, though, look for you to have been able to pass substantive legislative out of those meetings? And did that happen?
Well, the breakfast club that I was in, which was an equal number of Republicans and Democrats, smaller group, focused on issues and things that we could agree on. We came to terms on several issues. One, a bill I had, which was the One Act. It was a deal that says it means one new employee. If every small business were to hire one new employee, we would have a less than 5% unemployment rate. It gave it offered up some rebates if that were to take place. There was also one, a Home Ownership Act, which would treat savings for a home, whether it's the down payment or closing costs or something like that, like a medical savings account. It's not taxable. And there was great agreement with that. And then there was some just good government process issues of having a two-year budget and some other things that we agreed on. As far as moving anything, really, unless there was a crisis, nothing made it through the House, Senate, and to the president. I mean, it had to be the government was shutting down, the debts that we were reaching the limit on our debt ceiling, something like that. And if it wasn't that, the Senate just did not act.
You're listening to Intersections Ballot 2012 series on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with Congressman Dan Webster, candidate in Congressional District 10. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us about what issues are important to you by going on to our Facebook and Twitter page or send an email to intersection at WMFE.org. Congressman, jobs certainly on the minds of Central Floridians. What would you do to help improve job creation that would change things for your constituents if you were to go back and serve another term in Congress?
Well, I've done hundreds of tours of businesses, small, medium, and large. And it's almost unanimous. The one word I hear is certainty. Businesses want certainty. They want certainty in the tax code. They want certainty in the regulatory code. They want certainty in the economy so that the public would have confidence enough to buy their product or get engaged, and they could have the certainty that if they expand their business, they hire new employees, the rules aren't going to change tomorrow. That's what I hear all the time. And I have engaged myself in several pieces of legislation to move that forward. I talked about one, which is the One Act, but there are other things that we could get government out of the way, open up the opportunities so that businesses could have the confidence to hire, because right now they feel like just things are uncertain. And these continuing resolutions for 6 months or 3 months, and even the transportation bill, which is now 2 years, which everybody was rejoicing, but it ought to be five. I mean, really, for businesses to plan. Same with the tax codes, other things where we're doing these 1 year extensions or 2 year extensions. It just makes things so uncertain that businesses just can't act.
I want to talk just briefly about your opponent, Val Demings, former Orlando police chief. How would you say that you stand most apart from her?
I think most apart is that when I went to Washington and if I return again, my number one goal is to change the culture in Washington, not conform to the culture. And so I do something a little different than most people. I believe that we have to change the culture even by the way we campaign. I've never in my 30 years in elected office ever done a negative advertisement. I run on myself and what I've done. And if people like that, great. I use endorsements from other people and so forth. We'll never change the culture until we figure out a way to get there in a much better way. And so that's one of it. There's two other things. I think we need to change the way Washington approaches the process of making laws and the policy itself. But I do believe the way we get there is important. And I don't run, like I said, I don't do any negative advertising, whether it be radio, TV, or even print media. That's a difference. The norm on both sides is to rip the bark off somebody, true or false, doesn't really matter. And that, to me, is a culture that needs to go.
I want to ask you about health care. You support defunding and repealing the Affordable Care Act. What would you do as an alternative?
Well, what I can tell you what I wouldn't do and how I would approach it. First of all, what I wouldn't do is pass a 2,700-page bill that no one had read. The unintended consequences there are huge, and they've been found out. And a lot of them, even in bipartisan ways, we have passed pieces of legislation to fix some of that. One of them, a couple of them, have made it to the president because they were that flawed. So I wouldn't start with a huge rewrite, 2,700 pages long, that no one had read. To me, far better to take it a step at a time. And I believe there has to be some principles. When I was in the Florida House of Representatives as Speaker, we established principles before we headed out towards a solution, because then they become your guideline, and everybody, Republicans and Democrats alike, will know where you're headed. So for me, it's got to be the care we need from the doctor we choose at a price we can afford. Those would be the three principles I'd like to work off of. And if we do that, I think we can come to terms. And I believe that the Democrats and Republicans could embrace those principles.
I want to push you a little further on that. Going back into Washington, if you're reelected, do you think that Democrats are going to sit down and make major revisions like a lot of Republicans are calling for.
Well, I told you about the dinners. and the last dinner that we had, which was a huge dinner, barely got in to the place where we had been meeting because there were so many there. And again, it's an equal number of Republicans, Democrats. Republicans can't sit next to Republicans. That's the rule. You have to – it's Republican, Democrat around the table. After we finished listening to the others, the new people that came, we finally, after several dinners, broached the subject of issues. And the largest one is healthcare. That's the one we brought up. And we have in mind sitting down and laying it all out on the table. Everybody can talk. Everybody can give their side of it. And let's lay them out there and see if there's some common ground.
On social issues, Congressman, and during your career, certainly as a legislator, you've been socially conservative. You strongly oppose abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. Why do you feel so strongly on this issue?
Well, I believe it's just a definition of life. I believe, and there's no question about the fact that I'm a pro-life. It's unequivocally pro-life, and. In the end, there's too much evidence to say otherwise, and so it's no secret. But I believe also we have to work within what we can do. So I've never been one to go out on these edges to work on issues that will never pass. Instead, I'd like to do something about it. So when I did the parental consent, parental notification, the abolishing of the use of the procedure of the partial birth abortions, using a sonogram to allow women to at least know what's in their womb, so forth. Those are things that I've done, Choose Life license plate. I've worked on those. Even when I was Speaker of the House and we passed the ban on partial birth abortion, it was so well accepted that we overrode Governor Childs at the time by over two-thirds vote, bipartisan vote. So I try to work within that arena. I think those are some changes that could be done. And then in Washington, most of the votes we've had are on funding. I think there's a bipartisan support for the fact that they don't want to use money, federal money, to support the abortions.
And briefly, in closing summary, what would you describe as your vision for the country and Congress going forward if you head back to Washington?
Well, I think we're at a moment in time. And if there were a graph and there were a point on that graph that had to do with time and also the standing of this country among the world and even among ourselves, I think then 50 years from that point in time, no one's going to remember me or anybody else that's there. What I think they will remember is, did we continue on a spiral downward? I mean, if you think just even from an economic standpoint, we've gone from number one to number seven as far as the country that can best grow businesses and expand and so forth. So are we going to continue this spiral down? Or is this going to be the election that we turned around and went the other way? I think that, to me, is the key.
I've been speaking with Congressional District 10 candidate Dan Webster. Representative, very nice to speak with you.
Great to be on.
Up next, Deirdre McNabb, president of the League of Women Voters, on the state of voting in Florida. It's an election year, and in Florida, despite improvements to the voting system since the election of 2000, there is still controversy. It stems from state leaders proceeding with an effort to purge invalid voters from the rolls, and the state has a new election law in place this go-round. Both have faced ongoing court challenges. Democrats say both are aimed at disenfranchising minority and young voters. Deirdre McNabb is the president of the Florida League of Women Voters, and she joins me to discuss whether we're headed down another 2000-year election showdown. Good to talk to you, Deirdre.
Great to be with you, Mark. Good morning.
Let's start with this voter purge first. The Florida Department of State had planned to purge more than 2,000 possible non-citizens from the voter rolls. Citizens' rights groups stepped in when it became clear that some of those targeted were, in fact, valid voters. We talked to a spokesman from the Florida Department of State who says now The state will move forward with purging about 200 confirmed non-citizens from the rolls. Spokesman Chris Cate says he expects some voters will be removed before the November elections.
Yes, it is possible, but not without first being contacted. So nobody's going to be surprised that they would have been removed from the voter rolls, and the only people who would be removed from the voter rolls would be non-citizen ineligible voters. But there is a statutory removal process where anyone who's believed to be a non-citizen would be contacted and given 30 days to respond before anybody would be removed from the voter rolls. I expect some of the people who've already been contacted will be removed in time for the general election.
So, Deirdre McNabb, that's the word out of the Secretary of State's office in Tallahassee, spokesman Chris Cate. We heard what he said, but does this sound like it's going to violate to you a federal voting law that prevents purges within 90 days of an election?
Well, Mark, I would say this whole effort has been like going to the Ringling Brothers Circus. This began a few months ago with actually a list of 200,000. And subsequently, as that list was inspected, it got winnowed down to 2,000. These names were then sent out to our 67 independently elected supervisors of election with a follow-up note that came right after saying, a little bit like the Wizard of Oz, don't look behind that curtain. That list, I'm sorry about that. That was using obsolete information, inaccurate data. And then they finally got down to the 200. I think most Floridians have heard about the Triple Bronze Star winner that was on the list of the 200,000.
A veteran.
The veterans. So it really has been a rush to purge by the state using obsolete and out-of-date information. I think what's really important for people to know is we do have 67 independently elected supervisors of election who are very serious about fair elections and doing their job properly. They and their staff every single day are trying to keep our 12 million electronic voter database up to date. So it's not like no one's watching the store. These people are busy every single day trying to stay on top of the information. And then the Secretary of State's kind of jumping in with these lists from different places that turn to be obsolete and out of date. But that aside, I think the interesting comment to me was Mr. Cate's comment about the 30 days notice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of us go in and out of town. So if you happen to be out of town when you get the notice that you're going to be taken off, and then the election, we're now within 2 weeks of Election Day, we're not giving people due process. And we've seen already of history in Florida in 2000, we had tens of thousands of eligible voters taken off the rolls. So let's let the supervisors of election do their job. We believe that these purges are unlawful, and fortunately we're down to a very small number of names. We only wish the Secretary of State's office spent as much time worrying about getting eligible people who are not registered on the rolls as they worry about getting people off our rolls.
What do you think about that number of voters they're trying to get off? 200 voters is not a huge number, but let's remember that it was 537 votes that determined the outcome of the 2000 presidential election. Do you think that this could potentially have a big impact?
Well, I think the whole world is watching Florida, and I say that as not I think. Every day I get phone calls from Denmark. I was on the phone this morning for an hour with a man who writes for all the newspapers in Canada, Ethiopia, Norway. They're all watching Florida. Why? Because we've had a record of problems in this state, and based on what we've seen the legislature doing over the last year, it looks like they are doing some things that are likely to create some problems again, which we're deeply concerned about. The good news is that voters are charged up. They're paying attention. They're watching the debates. They're getting their voter registration up to date. We have a website, BeReadyToVote.org, where people can go to update their address. And I think all the voter suppression that we've seen out of the legislature has, in fact, motivated people to say, my voice will be heard this election.
Do you think, is there a problem with voter fraud in Florida?
Well, if there is, we haven't been able to get anybody from an elected position to share it with us, from the Secretary of State, even to Representative Baxley, who proposed the bill. When pressed, he just says voter fraud, but he has not come forward with any specific examples.
Let's just point out for our listeners, Representative Dennis Baxley, Republican from the Ocala area in the Florida legislature. Talk to me just very briefly about this election law that has been put in place this year. It changed the way that voter registration groups like the League of Women Voters turn in completed registration forms within 48 hours instead of 10 days or face penalties. A judge ended up blocking that provision. Another provision curtailed early voting days. That also blocked by courts in nearly all of Florida counties. So just very briefly, Deirdre, what's your assessment of the impact of this law approved a year ago?
Well, if I had to give it one word, it would be an appalling disappointment. After the year 2000, when we really were the poster child for how not to run an election, not just in the United States, but the whole world, we made a lot of huge improvements and changes, new machinery, paper trail, et cetera. Then the legislature that we currently have decided it was time to go back in time. And so they started to cut early voting, which had been enormously popular. Governor Crist had issued emergency extensions of voting hours for early voting. So, no, they cut it in half, got rid of half the days. They got rid of the most popular day for minorities. They saw groups like the League and many other groups who were not political parties who were out there registering voters, and they cut the legs out from those groups with restrictions and reforms. I'll give you an example of one. You want to register your cousin who moved from another state, you'd have to sign something that says this could be a third-degree felony. I know I might have to pay $5,000 in fine and 5 years in jail. These are very scary things. Court threw it out, said this is unconstitutional, there's no reason for it, and it was inaccurate. But it is really appalling to see our state, where we had been making progress, and in fact, I think by all accounts, 2008 was a very fair election. And that's what the League and many other groups want again in 2012. We want a fair election. Let's hear what the people of Florida have to say. We are a swing state. There is a lot of focus on it. And we were, I think saying we were gravely disappointed with the law, Mark, is an understatement.
Let me just ask you a last question here, and we'll keep this one brief, too. How unusual do you think this election year turmoil is in Florida, and do you think that these changes in laws and the background of this voter purge happening in the background there could also make this a showdown in Florida this coming election?
Well, I think Florida is going to be a pivotal state in the election this year, and it's not just what I think. It's, pundits all across the country that are knowledgeable in looking at the facts and the demographics of our state. As far as voter registration, we're very evenly divided. Demographically, we're a very, very diverse state. And so that alone is deserving of a lot of attention with 29 electoral votes. Now, added to that mix, the legislature's last-minute efforts to create chaos and confusion, thankfully, the supervisors have been fabulous. The 67 independently elected supervisors have been courageous and strong, and they are going to make sure that we have a fair election. But we're having to grapple with some bad laws that were put into place, like the requiring now of provisional ballots if you move from county to county, which is why we have our Be Ready to Vote, Update Your Address campaign. But I think some of the good news is that Florida citizens are paying attention. They are determined to get their vote cast. I think we're going to have a very high turnout in this state. And my hope is that at the end of the day, these laws will have the effect of galvanizing and energizing an electorate who say, I will not be kept away from this critical American liberty, my right to vote.
Deirdre McNabb is the president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Nice to speak with you.
Great to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online. Visit WMFE.org/intersection to find out more. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.